Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. President Donald Trump is ready to meet with jubilant Republicans at the White House, including House Speaker Paul Ryan.
Today, we take the next step to repeal and replace Obamacare.
They did it, barely. The House of Representatives just passed a Republican health coverage bill. President Trump says he'll hold a big press conference at the beautiful Rose Garden. That's scheduled for about 25 minutes from now, and we'll bring it to you live here on KUOW. Why did this bill pass? What's in it, and what happens next? Margo Sanger-Katz is a healthcare correspondent for the New York Times. Hi, Margo.
Hi.
A few weeks ago, House Republicans didn't have the votes to replace Obamacare. Why did it pass today?
Well, they've spent the last couple of weeks trying to make deals with various members of their caucus who were reluctant to vote for it. And the most important group are a group of very conservative members called the Freedom Caucus, who felt that the original bill didn't do enough to try to get rid of parts of Obamacare. And so an amendment was introduced that would allow states to waive a lot of the most important Obamacare insurance regulations. And so that was seen as enough to get their votes. And so that got them a little bit closer. Then there were some kind of more moderate members who were concerned about the effects of that those provisions, particularly concerned that it might be harder for people with pre-existing health conditions to get coverage under these waivers. And so there was a last-minute deal to spend a little bit more money to try to help protect people who had pre-existing health conditions. In the grand scheme of things, it actually isn't very much more money, but it seemed to be enough to get those holdouts to come back. And so it really came together very quickly through the result of a kind of old-fashioned congressional deal-making where leadership was talking with different groups of lawmakers and trying to figure out what it would take to get them to yes.
Here are two of those Republican lawmakers from Washington State. Eastern Washington Republican Kathy McMorris Rogers voted yes, saying this bill guarantees that access to health insurance coverage can't be denied for people with pre-existing conditions and empowers states to innovate with new models for better patient outcomes at a lower cost. Meanwhile, Western Washington Republican Dave Reichert voted no. He says the bill fails to protect vulnerable people, including older Americans, kids on Medicaid, and people with pre-existing conditions. How can two Republicans see it so differently?
Good question. I think it's pretty clear that the effects of this bill are going to be pretty bad for people who have pre-existing health conditions, at least in states that choose to take these waivers up. So, what the law would allow states to do is to get rid of a basic package of benefits that all health insurance plans would have to cover. So this would include things like prescription drug coverage, hospital care, doctor's visits, maternity coverage. So, if you imagine that states would tell insurers that they no longer had to cover all of those benefits, you might end up with some health plans that are less expensive but are less comprehensive. If you're really healthy, you might not care if your drug coverage isn't very rich or if you, can't get maternity coverage if you're not going to have a child. But, of course, if you're someone who has more health problems, who has more health needs, then the kind of richness of the benefits of your insurance is really going to matter in terms of whether it's useful for you and it protects you from financial harm.
So it's going
Similarly,
to be...
Similarly, they would be allowed to waive this really important rule in Obamacare that says that insurance companies have to charge the same price to customers regardless of whether they've been healthy or sick. So states that got waivers could, under certain circumstances, charge much higher prices to people who had been sick in the past. And so that could really lead to insurance becoming quite unaffordable for people who have expensive health conditions. I think that's the part that when you hear Republicans talking about their concerns about people with pre-existing conditions, that they're really most worried about.
So more choice returning to the states than stations like ours will be reporting on. In our case, how is Washington State going to react to this new flexibility if this bill stays intact and passes Congress this way and gets signed? So we'll be hearing more reporting on that. Meanwhile, I'm talking with Margo Sanger-Katz from the New York Times. A few weeks ago, the Congressional Budget Office told us that earlier health care bill would take away health insurance for tens of millions of people and add to the deficit. Where was the CBO report on this new version?
That's not quite right. The original CBO report found that it would make the deficit a little bit smaller. about $330 billion smaller over a decade. Mm. But it would result in, of course, many people, many millions of people losing their health insurance coverage. The CBO is nowhere to be found on this particular bill, which is not the CBO's fault. They are dutifully doing what they do. But because of the nature of the last-minute deal-making that was done to get this legislation over the finish line, there just hasn't been enough time for the CBO to look at all the changes and make the kind of calculations that they make in order to give lawmakers advice about the effects of legislation. So this is pretty unusual that the House would vote on a bill without hearing from CBO about who would have health insurance coverage as a result of these changes and how much it would cost the federal government. Of course, the CBO is doing that work now. The Democrats in the House say they've been told that there will be updated estimates available next week. And so presumably before the Senate votes on this bill or something like it, they will have a little bit more information about what the effects of the bill will be.
When the House bill failed a few weeks ago, Democrats said, yeah, that's because Americans hate this. And remember, there were angry constituents yelling at Republicans at town hall meetings. What happened to that resistance?
I think that resistance continues to exist. The polling of this legislation has all been quite negative. In general, Americans don't want this change to the healthcare system. But I think you have to understand that the House members and the House leadership are responding to a slightly different set of political incentives. They've been running for election for many years, promising that they were going to repeal and replace Obamacare. And I think that they were quite concerned that they would be letting down their voters if they didn't do something. And so this is an attempt to do something about Obamacare. It may not be the most popular piece of legislation, but I think for a lot of these legislators, it was important to keep their promises to their voters, and it was also important to protect themselves in the case of a primary, in their districts.
Any guess as to how this health insurance bill will change in the U.S. Senate?
So hard to predict. If you look at the statements that senators have made, Republican senators, it seems like they have a lot of discomfort with several really important provisions of this bill. And so my expectation is that if the Senate does vote on a health care bill, it will look quite a bit different than this one.
Yeah, so today's vote doesn't actually affect anybody's health insurance yet. So what are the politics? How worried do you think Republicans should be about losing control of Congress over this issue by the time all is said and done?
That is very much outside my particular area of expertise. I don't cover elections, and so I don't want to speculate about what it's going to mean for individual lawmakers in the coming years. But, you know, this is a very unpopular law. It's clear, if you believe the CBO, that some large number of Americans will be adversely affected by this law. There will be winners, and some of those winners may be likely to vote for the Republicans who passed the bill. But I think the kind of long-term political fallout really depends so much on what, if anything, passes in the end.
That's New York Times healthcare correspondent Margo Sanger-Katz. Margo, thanks for this.
Sure.
Also voting no today, all the Washington House Democrats and Republican Jamie Herrera Butler from Southwest Washington. Central Washington Republican Dan Newhouse was not there for the vote. President Trump plans a news conference in the White House Rose Garden in about 15 minutes with House Republicans. That's the schedule. We'll bring it to you live when it happens here on KUOW Seattle. The Netflix series 13 Reasons Why tells the story of Hannah Baker, a high school girl who kills herself. She leaves behind 13 recordings on cassette tapes, one for each person she says played a role in her decision to end her life.
I started with Justin and then Jessica, who each broke my heart.
Hey.
Alex, Tyler, Courtney, Marcus, who each helped to destroy my reputation. On through Zach and Ryan, who broke my spirit.
Some mental health professionals have a big problem with this series. You'll hear about that later. Right now, we go live to President Trump in the White House Rose Garden after passage of that Republican health care bill.
Speaker Ryan, Majority Leader McCarthy, Majority Whip Scalise, Chairwoman McMorris-Rodgers, Chairman Brady, Chairman Walden, Chairwoman Black, Congressman MacArthur, Congressman Meadows, and all the principled members of Congress who are standing with us here today, on behalf of President Donald Trump and the First Family, welcome to the White House. And thanks to the leadership of President Donald Trump, welcome to the beginning of the end of Obamacare. It was March 2010, 7 years ago. Democrats passed a government takeover of health care. And at that time, Republicans in Congress promised the American people that law would not stand. Today, thanks to the perseverance, the determination, and the leadership of President Donald Trump, and all the support of those gathered here, we've taken a historic first step to repeal and replace Obamacare and finally give the American people the kind of health care they deserve. So today, with heartfelt gratitude for all he has done to keep his word to the American people, and for all he will do to continue to make America great again, it is my high honor and distinct privilege to introduce to you the President of the United States of America, President Donald Trump.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mike. That's the group. Thank you. Thank you very much. This really is the group. What a great group of people. And they're not even doing it for the party. They're doing it for this country because we suffered with Obamacare. I went through 2 years of campaigning, and I'm telling you, no matter where I went, people were suffering so badly with the ravages of Obamacare. And I will say this, that as far as I'm concerned, your premiums, they're going to start to come down. We're going to get this passed through the Senate. I feel so confident. Your deductibles, when it comes to deductibles, they were so ridiculous that nobody got to use their current plan, this non-existent plan that I heard so many wonderful things about over the last 3 or 4 days after that. I mean, I don't think you're going to hear so much right now. The insurance companies are fleeing. It's been a catastrophe, and this is a great plan. I actually think it will get even better. And this is, make no mistake, this is a repeal and a replace of Obamacare. Make no mistake about it. Make no mistake. And I think most importantly, yes, premiums will be coming down. Yes, deductibles will be coming down. But very importantly, it's a great plan. And ultimately, that's what it's all about. We knew that wasn't going to work. I predicted it a long time ago. I said it's failing. And now it's obvious that it's failing. It's dead. It's essentially dead. If we don't pay lots of ransom money over to the insurance companies, it would die immediately. So what we have is something very, very incredibly well-crafted. Tell you what, there is a lot of talent standing behind me, an unbelievable amount of talent, that I can tell you. I mean it. And, you know, coming from a different world and only being a politician for a short period of time, how am I doing? Am I doing okay? I'm president. Hey, I'm president. Can you believe it, right? I don't know. I thought you needed a little bit more time, they always told me, more time, but we didn't. But we have an amazing group of people standing behind me. They worked so hard, and they worked so long. And what I said, let's do this. Let's go out, just short little shots for each one of us, and let's say how good this plan is. We don't have to talk about this unbelievable victory. Wasn't it unbelievable? So we don't have to say it again. But it's going to be an unbelievable victory, actually, when we get it through the Senate and there's so much spirit there. But I said, let's go out. We have a little list of some of the people. And I think after that list goes, if they don't talk too long, our first list, we're going to let some of the other folks just come up and say whatever you want. But we want to brag about the plan, because this plan really. Uh-oh. Oh. Well, yeah, we may. But we're just going to talk a little bit about the plan, how good it is, some of the great features. I want to thank Paul Ryan. He has worked so hard. And I was joking. I said, you know, Paul, for the last week, I've been hearing Paul Ryan doesn't have it. It's not working with Paul Ryan. He's going to get rid of Paul Ryan. Then today I heard Paul Ryan's a genius. He's come along.
I'll take whatever.
You know, the groups have all come together. We have the Tuesday group. We have so many groups. We have the Freedom Caucus. We have, and they're all great people. Well, we have a lot of groups, but they all came together. Really, Paul, I'd say in the last 3-4 days, especially in the last day, I see Mark and I see Kevin. I see so many people, Jim. We just have developed a bond. This has really brought the Republican Party together. As much as we've come up with a really incredible health care plan, this has brought the Republican Party together. We're going to get this finished, and then we're going, as you know, we put our tax plan in. It's a massive tax cut, the biggest tax cut in the history of our country. I used to say the biggest since Ronald Reagan. Now it's bigger than that. Also, pure tax reform. So we're going to get that done next. And this really helps it. A lot of people said, how come you kept pushing health care, knowing how tough it is? Don't forget, Obamacare took 17 months. Hillary Clinton tried so hard, really valiantly, in all fairness, to get health care through. Didn't happen. We've really been doing this for 8 weeks, if you think about it. And this is a real plan. This is a great plan. And we had no support from the other party. So I just want to introduce somebody to say a few words who really has been, I think, treated very unfairly, but it no longer matters because we won, and we're going to finish it off, and we're going to go on to a lot of other things, and we are going to have a tremendous 4 years, and maybe even more importantly, we're going to have a tremendous 8 years, but we're going to start off with just a great first year. And Paul Ryan, come up and say a few words. Congratulations on a job well done.
Thank you. You get thick skin.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you. Thank you for your leadership. There are too many people to name who played such an important role in helping us get to this part. But I want to thank a few people in particular. I want to thank Chairman Greg Walden, Kevin Brady, Diane Black, Pete Sessions, and the members of their committees for all the hard work they put into getting us to this point. I want to thank all the other members who contributed to making this the best bill possible. It really was a collaborative, consensus-driven effort. I also want to thank the team here at the White House. I want to thank Tom Price. I want to thank Mick Mulvaney. And I especially want to thank Reince Priebus. We could not have done this without you, gentlemen. You guys are the best. Of course, this would not have been possible if it weren't for these two gentlemen behind me. This is the fourth presidency I've served with. I have never, ever seen any kind of engagement like this. I want to thank Mike Pence, and I want to thank President Donald Trump for their personal involvement in working with our members and working to get this right, for getting this done and getting us to where we are. Thank you, gentlemen. Today was a big day. But it is just one step in this process, an important step. We still have a lot of work to do to get this signed into law. And I know that our friends over in the Senate are eager to get to work. They are. We're going to see that work through. You know why we're going to see this work through? Because the issues are just too important. The stakes are just too high. The problems facing American families are real.
And the problems facing American families as a result of Obamacare are just too dire and too urgent. Just this week, we learned of another state, Iowa, where the last remaining health care plan is pulling out of 94 of their 99 counties, leaving most of their citizens with no plans on the Obama market at all. What kind of protection is Obamacare if there are no plans to choose from? And this is a trend that we are seeing all across the country. The truth is, this law has failed and it is collapsing. Premiums are skyrocketing and choices are disappearing. And it is only getting worse, spiraling out of control. And that is why we have to repeal this law and put in place a real, vibrant marketplace with competition and lower premiums for families. That's what the American Healthcare Act is all about. It makes healthcare more affordable. It takes care of our most vulnerable. And it shifts power from Washington back to the states, and most importantly, back to you, the patient. Like I said, we've got a lot of work to do. But one thing is now clear. Republicans are committed to keeping our promise to lift the burden of Obamacare from the American people and put in place a better, more patient-centered system. It is my pleasure at this time to thank and to welcome to the stage someone who helped make this so possible, our very talented Majority Leader, Kevin McCarthy.
We'll pause it there for our live coverage of this news conference at the White House Rose Garden. This is KUOW Seattle, and you were just listening to House Speaker Paul Ryan, and before him, President Trump, speaking just after the Republican-controlled House passed its version of an Obamacare replacement. So Paul Ryan said it makes health care more affordable, it protects the most vulnerable. President Trump declared we won, said that premiums and deductibles will come down, and he predicted, Trump predicted the bill will pass the Senate, although the consensus among political observers so far is that the Senate is going to change the bill substantially. You heard one of those writers, New York Times healthcare correspondent Margot Sanger-Katz, just a few minutes ago. Dave Reichert, Washington Republican House member from King and Pierce counties, was one of the no votes, saying that this bill did not do enough to protect the most vulnerable. We are hoping to hear from Congressman Reichert. And we will continue to cover this story on KUOW Seattle, so stay tuned. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. On with the program now. We were telling you about the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why. It tells the story of Hannah Baker, a high school girl who kills herself, and she leaves behind 13 recordings on cassette tapes, one for each person she says played a role in her decision to end her life.
I started with Justin, and then Jessica. You each broke my heart.
Hey.
Alex, Tyler, Courtney, Marcus, who each helped to destroy my reputation. On through Zach and Ryan, who broke my spirit.
Some mental health professionals say this show could put teens with suicidal thoughts at even more risk. Shira Rosen is director of schools and higher education for Forefront, a suicide prevention program in Washington State. She works with schools and parents on how to talk about suicide with young adults. Hi, Shira.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You have seen this Netflix show, 13 Reasons Why. You watched it. What did you think?
Wow, I thought, first of all, it's really intense. I can see why youth, teens, all different ages are kind of getting sucked into the program and why people were watching it so much, that there's so much drama. It really talks about a lot of issues that are big and important for teens that have really come up. They come up in their lives that are part of their lives.
What kind of issues?
I mean, well, first of all, different mental health issues. I don't feel like the show touched upon that piece so well, but all the different challenges that go on while you're in school. So lots of shaming, bullying, there's sexual assault. Obviously, there's a suicide, which is the big piece of the show. And all of those pieces, I think, do touch teens and are part of their daily life at school. And a lot of those things can be happening.
As you mentioned, there is a suicide in the show, a scene where you see Hannah killing herself.
Yep.
What did you think of that?
Well, it's definitely graphic, and it definitely shows her doing the act and taking her own life. And I really think that's problematic. And the reason why is that I think that's extremely graphic, especially for teenagers to be watching. I think it glorifies it in some way. It shows how you can do it. It also...
But why glorifies? I mean, it's not like it's a happy development in the show.
Right. I don't... Maybe that specific piece doesn't fully glorify it. I think the show does in some ways, in that she's leaving behind 13 tapes and she's blaming lots of people. And then all of a sudden, she's very popular and everybody's talking about her and her life is kind of built up in a way because of the tapes and how much is going on centered around her after she's taken her life. And so I think all of it kind of leads up to that, and the whole show kind of glorifies suicide in a way that I think is not helpful. And it's really not helpful, especially for vulnerable youth.
Is it fair to say that this show, 13 Reasons Why, portrays suicide as a reasonable solution?
I feel like it really does. I think in some ways it does show that when things are really bad, one way you can do it is to take your own life. And that's one of the options. And then when you do that, you'll be really popular. You know, everybody will be talking about you. You'll kind of live on constantly afterwards. And I think that's a really bad message to be giving out to anybody, including teens. And so I think that is really problematic, and that it can be really, really triggering for vulnerable teens, I think is a big piece of the challenge too, is that having graphic rape scenes and a graphic suicide scene can really be triggering and a problematic for kids.
We're talking with Shira Rosen with the suicide prevention group Forefront. What kinds of conversations should parents have with their kids about suicide?
Yeah, so I'd say in general about suicide and this show, first of all, it'd be great to watch it with your kid. If they're
really, you would recommend that?
I wouldn't necessarily recommend watching it, but if you know that your kid is going to watch it or that they already have, many times, you know, your teen has already watched a show and you're not up on all the shows they've seen,
right.
Watch it yourself and know what they're talking about. And then you can have conversations. And I think the one benefit I can see from the show is it is raising the conversation about suicide.
Well, that's interesting.
This is a taboo topic.
Mm-hmm.
And that it is important that we're having these conversations. That's part of the work that we do in schools, is to really provide training and provide support and provide strong policies and procedures within schools, but also to bring the culture where people are talking about suicide, that it's not just a taboo topic, because the more we can talk about it, the more we can see what kids are in distress, what teens are having problems, who really needs help and support.
Okay, so let's say your kid has watched this Netflix series. Then how do you use that to talk about suicide?
Absolutely. So I think one thing is to talk about who's the hero in this show. The girl, Hannah, who takes her own life is really portrayed as the hero, as the focal point of this show. That's not usually what happens when somebody takes their life. That's not the reality of what's going to happen. She's gone. She's not going to be back. So having those conversations, having discussions about bullying, you know, does it happen in your school? What's going on? Is it happening to you? Are you seeing this happen? Talking about sexual assault, same thing. Like, these open up conversations for those type of topics. And also, what adults do you have in your life? Who do you have? Who could you go to?
Well, Netflix has said they're going to add a content warning at the start of the first episode and give some suicide prevention information at a website. What should Netflix do now? What do you want from them?
Yeah, I think now, again, the challenge is it's a little bit too late. I think putting on those warnings would have been great at the beginning. I think it's unfortunate that that didn't happen. I think it's great that they're going to do that. But again, I think most teens who want to see that show have already seen it. So what I would like them to do is just address it more. I think they just had this huge hit as a show that's about suicide. What a great way to then educate and do different things, work with organizations that do suicide prevention, like really get more involved in that community and get the word out to teens. Netflix is a huge, powerful tool that many teens are watching. Many people in our country are watching, you know, Netflix regularly. There's so many ways they could do more education and getting the word out about it, and not just on that series, because are kids, teens, going to go back and watch it again? Possibly not. So this whole group may not get any of that information because they've already watched it. So I'd like to see them add that into other elements that they have and really try to get the word out about suicide prevention with lots of resources available.
We're talking about the problems with this Netflix show, and I'm wondering how mainstream America is reacting. How aware Are they of the right way to talk about suicide? I know it's a hit for teens. Is Netflix embroiled in a controversy right now? Or are even people even noticing that this is a problem?
Yeah, I'd say it's really mixed. I've heard from plenty of adults who've seen the show and talked to plenty of people who are talking to their friends. And I think it's really mixed. Some people see it, say, oh my gosh, that was horrible. Here's all the problems with the show. Other people have seen it. Wow, that was such great drama. And it's talking about suicide, and that's great. And maybe have missed some of the challenges and problems. And I would say that's typical. I think as people view things on TV, in the movies, take in media, many people just take it in for entertainment value, or, oh, that was enjoyable to watch, or, oh, that was hard to watch, but it brought up some feelings.
Adults included.
I would say so, absolutely. I think that's true generally with media, and just as much so with this show. And I think adults have very different takes on it depending on where they're coming from. And I think the suicide prevention community has brought lots of the issues to the forefront, to, you know, the front line, to really talk about this. And it's making people think more critically about the show. But I think in general, not just the show, lots of different shows, people don't always think critically. And it's more for the drama and the enjoyability of watching a show.
Shira Rosen, Director of Schools and Higher Education for Forefront. Thanks for talking with us about this Netflix series and how maybe we can do better next time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Shira Rosen, Director of Schools and Higher Education for Forefront. And here's one more piece of information. Remember, there is a National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and that is 800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Today, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives passed its version of a bill to repeal and replace President Obama's Affordable Care Act. And a few minutes ago, we brought you live the sound of President Trump and House Speaker Paul Ryan and other Republicans applauding and exulting and generally being exuberant at the White House Rose Garden, with President Trump predicting that this measure would pass the Senate, saying, "We won. I did what I promised. Premiums and deductibles will be coming down." However, Western Washington Republican Dave Reichert from King and Pierce County, the 8th District, he was a no vote on this bill, and he joins us live. Congressman Reichert, thank you for coming. Why did you vote no?
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on. My job as a representative is to closely look at this legislation, at all legislation, and determine whether or not it meets the standard that I think the American people are looking for, especially when you start to talk about, you know, such a personal topic as health care. So there are a number of things in this bill that didn't meet the standard I think that my constituents would expect. And number one, I think just as a fiscal conservative, and hope some of your listeners fall into that category, I'm sure, probably wouldn't vote for a bill if you didn't know what it cost. And so this bill today had some, as you know, some additions to it,
mm-hmm.
in the billions of dollars that have never been scored by CBO. So no score, that was one issue, but really the main driving issue for me was some of the gaps left in coverage for people. And you've, again, probably familiar with some of these, but in the Medicaid arena, we have an $800 billion cut. And so what happens there is that for the next few years, people can enlist in Medicaid, you can enroll in Medicaid, and you're going to be grandfathered into the current Medicaid system. But in January 2020, any new enrollees then will face the possibility of reduced benefits, reduced coverage, and reduced services, and or I think there will be a possibility that some children, disabled individuals, seniors, and children may not be covered. And there are, you know, when you look at the services that are, the service that I'm talking about, for example, if it's determined that a child or some disabled person needs 20 hours of therapy, and that's currently the measure today in January 2020 because of the extensive cuts, those services, the services that may be available may only be 10 hours, it may only be 5 hours. The services won't be to the level that the patient may need. The same goes with personal care hours at home. When parents need that additional care at home, those hours could be cut.
What about the issue of pre-existing conditions that's gotten so much attention?
Yeah.
There's an argument going on. It does protect people with pre-existing conditions. It doesn't.
Well, and so as you probably again are aware, after I passed out of the Ways and Means Committee, this bill changed quite a bit. And one of the changes that just occurred over the last day was an amendment that was produced by Mr. Upton, Fred Upton, who said, you know, and we brought this to the attention of the president and the vice president. I've had opportunities to meet and talk with him a couple of times over the past 2 days. And we brought this attention to him, and we said, look, there is a situation or situations where a person could fall into this coverage gap. So if, let's say that you're 25 and a half and you develop a serious illness, you fall off your parents' coverage at 26, you're unemployed, you have 60, and you have no insurance, you have 63 days to get insurance. If you don't, if you're outside that 63-day window and then you come back into the insurance care system, then you may be facing higher premiums. The $8 billion was added to cover that gap. The problem with that is that it's only a 5-year period, and so it's a temporary fix, and you and I know that if you've got pre-existing some serious illness, this is usually not an illness that's going to be cured in the next 3 weeks or in the next 5 days. These are long-term illnesses that people have to face, and to look at 5 years and then all of a sudden wonder now what's going to happen. And the other issue is the $8 billion.
Adding to the deficit?
It adds to the deficit, but it doesn't. It may not even be enough to cover the need for for those people. The other issue is for the older Americans is that in Obamacare, you can charge seniors 3 times the amount as younger people in the system. That's because seniors use more health care. That was under Obamacare. In the new law, it was you could charge up to 5 times more. So that was increased. But under the MacArthur Amendment, again, it was a change that was made in the last few days, there was no cap on that. So if a state wanted to, under the waiver system, if they wanted to, they could increase that to 10 times as much as other individuals in the system or higher.
We're talking with Western Washington Republican Dave Reichert, a member of Congress who voted no, and it was a close vote. His no vote did not stop this bill from passing in the House. Obviously, President Trump is acting like, the Senate's going to pass it too. Everyone I've spoken to expects substantial changes in the Senate. Either way, it sounds like the states are going to get more power to make some big decisions here, not just decisions coming down from the federal government. So what can you tell your listeners right now that Washington State is likely to do for them regarding health insurance?
Well, I think the good news about Washington State is that we've actually set up a pretty good system. So our state legislative body has been very thorough in the way that they've constructed our exchange. So in the state of Washington, it'd be very unlikely that the governor or state legislators would ask for and support a waiver request. The difficulty comes when, in 2020, what impact will occur to the Medicaid population, and especially, again, to those disabled seniors and disabled and special needs children. Those are the people that really need the help, and there will be obviously less money to address those issues, and my fear is that because of that, the services could be reduced.
Dave Reichert, Republican member of Congress from Washington State, the 8th District, covering parts of King and Pierce counties. A no vote today, but the Republican-pushed health care bill passes in the House today. goes to the U.S. Senate. We'll be following those changes and how Washington State is going to use its possible new flexibility under this new Republican version of health insurance coverage.
Jason, if I may say so, let me just tell you that we are going to be working closely with the Senate to address these issues that I just explained.
Mm-hmm.
We need to have those fixed.
Okay, that's what we'll be covering next. Yep. Dave Reichert, thanks for joining
us.
Thank you.
Yep.
Congressman Reichert, and you're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. It's KUOW's The Record. This spring, the U.S. Forest Service will be setting fire to more than 9,000 acres of land in the Okanagan-Wenatchee National Forest. Those fires, set on purpose by government agencies, are called controlled burns or prescribed burns, and they're meant to prevent even bigger forest fires, like the ones that burned here in 2015. Fighting fire with fire? Does that seem a little counterintuitive? The Washington Prescribed Fire Council's Reese Lawley says, yeah, it is.
It's counterintuitive, right? But really, we need fire every year in the right place and right time in Washington. Many of the places that we love and care about in Washington are fire-adapted, actually fire-dependent. So from South Puget Sound and the San Juan Islands, prairies and woodlands, and millions of acres of dry forest in eastern Washington, evolve and depend on the regular intervals of low-intensity fire to thrive. And then secondly, really using controlled burning or prescribed fire to protect public safety. So our forests are in a condition in many places in eastern Washington, especially our dry forests, where we have such fuel buildup in those forests that in the middle of the summer in August, when it's very hot and dry and windy, it's very hard for crews to manage those fires in really intense conditions.
Will you say more about this idea that the forests evolved with fire? Will you explain that?
If you think about when Europeans came to North America, Native Americans were thriving and living in North America. And if you think about the source of most fire, lightning, and then and Native Americans using fire. So a lot of our forests, prairies, and grasslands had periodic fire. So we have certain ecosystems like the prairies and woodlands of the San Juans and South Puget Sound that burned every 5 to 15 years, and also millions of acres of dry forest in eastern Washington that burned every 5 to 15 years. And so plants and animals adapted to that frequent fire, in the sense that they had strategies to survive. And so what happened is with Europeans coming to North America, we had a different view of fire. And so in around the early 1900s, we had this discussion and debate was going on in the sense of the Native American use of fire, where you're putting fire to work, using fire to manage the forests and prairies around us, to a European type of forestry that really came from a perspective of excluding fire, not using fire. So that was a vigorous debate happening in the early 1900s. About 1910, or in 1910, there was the big fire, the big burn, where what happened there was over 3 million acres of fire burned across Washington, Idaho, and Montana, and killed over 80 people. And with that debate was squelched. And from that moving forward, we had an all-out war on fire. And we suppressed fire and excluded fire from our systems. And that worked very well up until around the 1980s. We have impressive fire suppression crews and very good at being able to put out fires, which is a very necessary tool. And then what happened around the 80s, we started having more of a warming climate. And during that period of time, we had a lot more fuel buildup as well. And so our forests change. We have a lot more forest cover, a lot denser forests and tighter spaced forests now. And so now we have a condition where it is harder and harder to suppress those fires. So when we have lightning ignitions or human-caused ignitions, it's harder to put those fires out. And so we have a period now where that started to cost us more and more, millions and billions of more dollars to fight. And so we're really looking at now, how do we integrate fire back into those systems both for the benefit of those ecosystems, but for protecting communities as well.
We had a record-setting rainy season here on the west side just now. What's the weather been like in central and eastern Washington?
So, you know, I've been in eastern Washington for over 10 years and lifelong resident of Washington, and it, very cold winter, wet winter, so a lot of snowpack, very cool. So if we think back to 2 or 3 years ago, 2014 and 15, where it was much drier and hotter, and we had conditions that were more conducive to fire. But this year, we have a scenario where it is cooler and wetter. And what we're going to see is that's more moisture, which means more moisture means more growth in some of the fuels. And so we'll see this summer what it's like in how much it dries out and how wet a rainy season we have in thinking about our wildfire season coming up.
Reese, it seems like we can't win. We have a dry season and we're freaked out about the danger of forest fire. We have a wet season and you're saying, oh no, we've got all this growth now from all the moisture and that's just going to burn.
It does seem that way, like we can't win. But we can. We can think about our history and think about moving forward where we've excluded fire. We haven't really put fire to work. We've really reacted to fire in our history. That's turning around, where we're really looking at how do we get smarter about working with fire and thinking about our forests and grasslands and managing them in a way that we can use fire for the things we care about and want to sustain: clean water, wildlife, healthy forests, those elements of what we value. And we can use fire to, when we have those big fire seasons, to help manage it in a way that we get the benefit of fire versus it really destroying and impacting the values we care about.
Well, one reason we moved away from controlled burns is that occasionally they go wrong, right? They can get out of control.
There is that risk. You never want to be on the other end of the statistic, but there are hundreds of thousands of prescribed fires that are lit and managed annually across the U.S., very rare, under very few percentage points of where there is an actual escape and where there's damage. On the other hand, we do live, and I don't think we think about this fully, but we live in a fire environment in Washington, especially in central and eastern Washington. We will have fire. It's just a matter of when and how. And so using controlled burning with the application of fire does have a risk, but the risk of doing nothing and saying, well, that's just nature and wildfire, there's nothing we could do about that, is not quite accurate. And there are huge risks of doing nothing. And we saw that in 2014 and 15 to a lot of communities of the impact those wildfires had.
Reese Lally is chair of the Washington Prescribed Fire Council, and the Forest Service plans to burn more than 9,000 acres this spring in the Okanagan-Wenatchee National Forest. This is KUOW's The Record. KUOW's new podcast, called How's Your Day?, tells a story you don't know from a day we all remember. April 20th, 2010, an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico exploded, killing 11 workers. Worst oil spill in history. Meanwhile, in Long Island, New York, Kayla Gertis had a disaster of her own that changed the lives of two people forever.
I remember waking up in my friend's apartment. To the eye, it looked, you know, white walls, typical apartment. But to me, it was gloomy because of the energy in it. Especially when you wake up the next morning, you're not really high anymore. So things kind of look how you feel. So it's just like, ugh, like this dragged down feeling. And, you know, the night before we had been doing drugs. So I had woken up to him kind of like arguing with me or saying something. I don't know, I had probably did something stupid the night before because I was in a blackout the night before. But I had to go to court. And so my mission was, I need to get to court. I don't care what's going on, like, I need to get to court. My mother, I was 18, so she couldn't really put me into rehab because I was 18. So she put an order of protection against me because she thought that would make the judge send me to rehab. So it was like just her way of trying to get me help. The irony.
I understand how serious this situation is. It is a tragedy. I want to speak directly to the people who live and work in the Gulf region. I know that this incident has had a profound impact on your lives.
It could turn out to be the worst environmental disaster in more than 20 years.
I hear comments sometimes that large oil companies are greedy companies or don't care. But that is not the case in BP. We care about the small people.
Brian was driving, and I was sitting in the van. I remember my mother calling and, you know, us saying we're late. And she told him, don't let her drive. When you're on Xanax, literally, like, the lights are on, but nobody's home. I told him, I was like, if you don't pull over, I'm going to walk there or find another way because you're going the wrong way and I cannot be late. So then he pulled over. I remember driving a little bit and then going to make like a 3-point turn. And when I like hit the curb, when instead of hitting the brake, I hit the gas. I almost have this image in my head that I remember of that morning of like, it's like I saw her like in my peripheral. Like I'll never lose that image in my head. And I don't know if it's a real image, but it's just there. And the van went right through the house.
On KUOW, that is an excerpt of our podcast, How's Your Day? You can hear more episodes at KUOW.org.